This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson. Labor unions are still pushing back against Missouri's right to work law that's set to go into effect on August 28th. The latest efforts to block the controversial legislation is through a petition that Mark Baker, a business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and Cameron Redd, who works for the United Steelworkers International, both say has a good chance at putting right to work back on the ballot in 2018. Mr. Redd and Mr. Baker, thanks for joining me.
We do appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Mr. Redd, I want to start with you with this petitioning process. Can you talk about what it is that you all are petitioning and how this works? Because there are a lot of steps to this whole petition.
Our petition is to get this issue on the ballot for 2018. If we are successful, which we believe we will be, it prevents this law from taking effect on August the 28th, and every registered Missourian will have a chance to vote on this issue in the next election. It's a very big deal, and we think that the people should have the final say on this, not the politicians in Jefferson City. We think the people ought to have the final say, and that's what the petition is about, and that's what it does.
Okay, and so how many signatures are necessary for this petition to go to that next step?
The law says to get a ballot initiative to be successful, you need 5% of the total amounts of votes cast in the prior gubernatorial election. And you need that 5% spread out over 2/3 of the congressional districts in the state of Missouri. So for us, we have 8, so we need to qualify in 6 of 8 districts.
How likely is that to happen?
We feel it's very likely. We're very confident that we will indeed qualify in all 8. That's the goal. Instead of 2/3, we want to qualify in 100%.
Now, with right to work, it's been this ongoing thing of those who support it and those who are opposed to it. And I'll ask you this, Mr. Baker, like, what is the challenge in getting people to understand that this is not a piece of legislation that benefits the worker? And that's been an argument that's been commonly made by those who oppose it.
Well, from my perspective, I think the first question or comment that I would offer somebody is, take a look at who's sponsoring this legislation, who is supporting it, who is advocating for it, who is testifying in favor of it. It's not any of the labor unions who, by the way, are a business. And, you know, whether we like it or not, they have to stay solvent. They have to make financial decisions every day. But historically, these people, the Chamber of Commerce's that support these right to work laws, they're not looking out for the blue collar worker, the people that put in their 8, 10, 12 hours a day. They're sponsored on the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers, you know, out of state, out of touch, well funded groups. And I think that's where people should really take a good hard look at who is pursuing it, who's benefiting from it. You know, I think you need to step back and be careful to vote on one particular issue. I'm guilty of it myself, but I try to protect my pocketbook at first, and then I'll donate the money that I make to other worthy social charitable causes. The challenge is to get people to understand what their best interest is. And I think there's a book out called What's the Matter with Kansas, written several years ago. And it really examines the issue of why do people sometimes vote against their best interest? And I think it's about misdirection. It's about misleading. It's about taking people away from what really matters to them. You know, when you want to talk about a certain issue that may or may not ever affect somebody personally, but you can get them emotionally charged up over it, then I think that's where they're trying to succeed, you know. I mentioned back in February here in Missouri, the private sector is roughly around 8% unionized. The reflection or the curiosity was this law would essentially affect about 8% of the represented workforce here in the state of Missouri. So why was it such a big deal? Why was it pursued so hard? And I think, you know, through this petition signature gathering, we've discovered a lot of people that aren't in unions come up to sign these petitions because they understand the unions, although they may not be perfect, they are the perfect vehicle for working families, whether they're in a union or not. You mentioned earlier when we were talking off the air, the way the economy has changed. I think that's one of the single largest challenges our labor unions face today, is examining whether or not they have changed in their leadership style, within their representational style, to serve their membership and to organizing new members as well. And I think each and every international local union has that challenge laid out ahead of them, because the economy, the workforce has changed and is forever more changing. I've seen several videos that talk about, you know, the top 10 jobs 3 years from now aren't even in existence yet. So the technology and the workforce, their wants and needs and desires are changing at an ever-growing pace, almost exponentially at times. And I think that's where, I'm not saying we have to reinvent ourselves, I'm saying our message has to be restated time and time again.
To touch on part of what Mark said, the opposition that organized labor unions have taken against these type of bills have to do with the fact that although Right to Work has a pretty title, it doesn't have a pretty track record.
We'll go into that.
So if you were to do a Google search of maps of the states with the highest poverty or the perhaps the poorest state, some kind of search along those lines, you'll see the same states listed over and over. If you Google Right to Work and then were to print that map out, a lot of times it overlays about 95% of the time it overlays perfectly with these Right to Work states. So Right to Work has a pretty title, but not a pretty record. A lot of people in this area point to Blytheville about the steel mills down there, and that was, you know, they stated this up in Jefferson City. Oh, if we was only Right to Work, you know, we would have steel mills and we would have this and we would have that and everybody would come and it's all a wonderful thing. But when you move on down past Blytheville and on into the state, that's a very, very poor state. It's Right to Work. It's been Right to Work for a long time. So if Right to Work is so good and it's going to do all these wonderful things, how come it hasn't done it for these states that have been Right to Work for a long time? If you look at states that have been Right to Work for more than 10 years, you'll see many of the same things: high poverty, high infant mortality, things like that people don't normally associate with unions, but it has to do with wages. And again, like Mark said, when you look at, say, the Koch brothers, that's two individuals, too, that have invested more, according to public record, more than $2 billion, $2 billion in the last three election cycles to buy their candidate, and they push Right to Work. So what's the return on their money? Why are they pushing for this? And what is the record of Right to Work in these other states?
Well, going into that, Mr. Baker, when we first talked, you were talking about that this Right to Work won't, these changes are not going to happen overnight. You'll see them gradually. Can you talk more about what you meant by that?
Well, I think it's a long con, in my opinion. I always like to reference the movie The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman. And, you know, they had set up, you know, a couple of these bets that were placed by the guy they were scamming, and you know, like Cameron said, they've captured you with a pretty title, but you know, when you look at the track record of this Right to Work, it just erodes and nibbles away a little bit at a time. And maybe the goal is not to squash wages and to cut them in half, but to drastically slow them down or stop them from ever increasing. So it's to facilitate and encourage an ever-increasing wage gap between, I used to say that the top third, or, you know, the middle third and the bottom third, but it's so disparagingly different than what even the public perception would be. This top 1, 2, and 3%, it's off the chart, unrecognizable. You know, and when Cameron says the billions with a B, as in boy, you can't fathom that. I don't fathom $1 million, let alone 1,000 of those millions to be a billion. The long-term goal of this, and we've discussed the rural local unions, sometimes with larger geographic areas, have a bigger challenge to cover more ground with less resources. You know, it's to starve us out. It's to deplete the funds of the union by encouraging people that are covered under the collective bargaining agreement to not join and to not pay their dues. And it just weakens worker power to the point that they would like to see our existence be gone. And that will, that's a sad day for the working class America. And it's disappointing and frustrating that there's a segment of our population out there that takes that position.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Baker and Cameron Redd about the recent efforts to block the right to work legislation from going into effect in August.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. If you've been tuning in, I've been talking about the latest attempts to block the controversial right-to-work law from going into effect with Mark Baker, a business representative from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and Cameron Redd, who works for the United Steelworkers International. Here's more from our conversation. Are there fewer amount of labor unions in more rural areas than there are in city urban communities where they, you know, they have, if you're in a city area, you have more ability to kind of, you know, push back with the employer in question, and you can debate this, that, and the other. But if you're in a smaller community, a rural setting in particular, does it make it harder for a labor union to try to push back on some of those things that they don't have the financial abilities to do so?
Lessening the amount of money you have to work with naturally has an effect when it comes to right to work. A lot of time in the rural areas, they don't have, there's not a lot of factories, at least down in our way. So there's more unions in the city. There's more industry and places organized. And to me, one of the biggest reasons that they organize is the ability to have a voice. And to me, there's a lot of benefit for me to be a union employee. But I think the number one benefit for me is the just clause. If you work for me, and this is a non-union place, I can come in today and say you're fired. I don't have to give you a reason. I can fire you for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason, right? The only thing that I couldn't fire you for legally is an illegal reason. If you were black, and I don't like black peoples, and I come in and I say, I don't, it's not working out, you're too black. Or women don't belong in this job. Or something crazy like that.
So discriminatory.
Something discriminatory. They're not going, when they come to dismiss you, they're not going to say that even if it's true. They're going to just say, we don't need you. So all the burden is on you. If you felt like you were mistreated for whatever reason, or you were singled out for an illegal reason, and mind you, they can fire you for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason. If you were in a union under the just right clause, they have to have a reason to dismiss you. And the burden of proof is on the company to prove you done something wrong. So if you're in a rural setting and there's one factory, and it's non-union, you will put up, and I know firsthand, you will put up with a lot more maltreatment, and you will do things that you know in your mind are not safe, but you've got to get this done, and you were told to do it. Whereas if you work in a union shop and you're told to do something unsafe, you have the right to say, hey, that's unsafe. You know, we need to get a safety man out here and look at this. You know, what you're asking me to do is against your own rules, something like that. And so it's kind of like innocent until proven guilty. So without a union, it's you're guilty till you prove yourself innocent before the labor board. I heard somebody say, you got a labor board, you don't need a union. Try taking on a billion-dollar company with no money and no job because you were unjustly dismissed. So, again, I believe it's the amount of industry in St. Louis versus the amount of industry down where we're at. The reason there's a lot of unions up there and not too many down here. To the economic question, union workers typically have better wages and better insurance, a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, you know, is kind of the mantra, you know, a safe workplace. And in that respect, a good union job in a rural area, most of the time is your highest paid and your most well-off people. And that benefits the state also.
I want to go into something that we discussed earlier in this conversation. If this legislation is not blocked, what will that mean for labor unions in the future? Will labor unions still be seen as the lifeline for workers in Missouri? And either one of you can take a stab.
Well, I think there is an optimistic goal that even if right to work becomes the law of Missouri, all it essentially does on a technicality is take out the union security clause. In a best case, perfect utopia for the labor movement, every single person covered under a collective bargaining agreement would still choose to pay their proportionate dues, whatever that structure is. The treasurer of the union would stay up. They could still continue their excellent job of representing their members. That's the one, I guess, maybe rose-colored glasses look at it. The most radical opposite effect would be, you know, if most or all members stop paying their dues and the unions were still forced to represent them, your treasury of your unions are going to be drained very rapidly. That's what the people supporting this legislation are really after. They would like to see us gone yesterday. Because they want total control, total say-so. And I think the challenge is going to be we still have to prove to our members that there is value in their dues. I hope we have done that. Actually in the public sector, we've got one open shop right now, and we're probably at 97%, you know, affiliation rate. So our members do see and do understand the value that we bring to the table. Probably 9 years ago, we were called to a little municipality south of Cape Girardeau. And Cameron was talking about personal experience a while ago and why your employer can fire you. The history had been at this small town that I won't name. Every 2 years when the council had changed hands or the mayor had changed hands, they got rid of the people that were employed there and brought in their friends that helped get them elected. These people came to us, and they didn't say, we're getting treated crummy, there's unsafe work here, we're not getting paid anything. They said, I don't want to lose my job at the next election. And the employer, the municipality, was very hesitant to sit down and negotiate a first contract with us, but we eventually did get there. Over time, I think we are developing a relationship. We now have those members covered under our national IBEW insurance plan. It is the best insurance plan in the nation that we are aware of. And we're building some trust and some working relationships back and forth where some of our members there are getting some wage increases to the level to where they, I'm not saying they would compete with private industry, but where they are being recognized for the good work that they are doing. And I think we have to continually strive to not necessarily reinvent, but to prove that we are worthy of what we're charging.
That was Mark Baker, a business representative from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and Cameron Redd, who works for the United Steelworkers International. That music means that's it for today, but you can find our conversation at krcu.org or on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.